Hey, it's episode 434 of the 343 Podcast. Today's episode is a very important one. It's not about tactics. It's not about technique or any of the soccer, super soccer specific things, but it's one of the most important things that you need to be listening to. And that is about the media, the soccer media here in the United States, because depending on what you consume is how your brain is going to be wired. And depending on how your brain is wired is how you're going to behave in the ecosystem. What it is that you believe about football, what it is that you think is true, what you think is not true. And guess what? That gets translated and expressed through your coaching. That gets translated and expressed through your parenting. That gets translated and expressed through your content creation. Are you on the side of reality? Or are you on the side of people who don't know what the F they're talking about and they programmed your mind? Here we go. Speaking about getting good information for you as a coach or you as a parent, coaches, you need to go to 343coaching.com. There are free and premium programs for you there. How do you know whether this is a good program for you, yes or no? Well, we eat our own dog food. We have been coaches for multiple decades and have done pioneering and remarkable work here in the United States of America, from U9 up through graduating youth players to the college ranks, to the professional ranks. And we also have worked in the professional ranks for the better part of a decade. So we've seen all the cycles, all the ages, just everything under the sun. So yeah, when it comes to who you should be learning from, I have no qualms about promoting our own stuff, which is, by the way, what sponsors this podcast. We don't accept any other sponsors. So coaches, do yourself the biggest favor of your entire careers and go to 343coaching.com. There are free programs and premium programs for you there. If you've known us for a long period of time, you know what we're about, you know the work that we have accomplished, you should hop on board the premium program. Don't even wait. Dive headfirst into it. And parents, the same goes for you. With all our experience, we've codified it and tailored a program just for you so you can better guide and mentor your kids. That is at 343masterclass.com. 343masterclass.com is where you want to go. And coaches who are coaching in the 7-versus-7 format, you should go to 7v7coaching.com. All right, everybody, I hope you enjoy this critically important episode about the American soccer media. Here we go.
A lot's going on, Gary, and you and I are always chatting back and forth about whatever's happening in the world of soccer. And I feel like this is a good opportunity to kind of shine a light on the U.S. soccer media and why it's such a problem. How many things are like, there's so many examples of what's wrong with it. And why it is that it holds us back as a soccer nation. The first thing I want to talk about, I think, is just the whole debacle around Pochettino and the media momentum question. He rests the starters against Turkey, and he rests 10 of them, right? And they end up losing. It's nearly a draw. Turkey gets kind of this miracle goal right at the end, right? It's good work. Pulisic gets nutmegged and they come out with the win, but it's like the U.S. had already secured their group. Nothing was in question there. So really nothing's lost. And for me, I kind of thought like, this is perfect. Everybody gets a rest. McKennie stays active, right? The one thing I think I wouldn't have done is rested Matt Fries. I probably would have left him in, but I'm not Pochettino. Like, I'm just some dude. And then Pulisic's healthy, right? And everybody that was on a yellow stays away. They give up the goal late. And the media kind of loses it. And they say, oh, well, now you've killed momentum. And then Poch lost it on them. I think rightfully so, but I want to get your take on that.
I think going into that match, I wasn't sure what Pochettino was going to do. But if I had to bet, I was going to bet that he was going to do what he did, which is, hey, all the yellow card guys, you're not playing. Pulisic, it's day by day. Let's see if I play you, if I don't play you, if I do play you, maybe at the very end. I was actually kind of surprised that he actually played him in the later stages of the match. And I'm not surprised as much maybe as you were getting Turner in instead of Fries because, look, first off, I don't know anything about goalkeeping. I've admitted that for 15 years now. I don't know. But from my amateur viewpoint, I can't see a big difference between the two keepers. unlike, say, the Argentine keeper and the second string Argentine keeper, there's a huge gap there. So if you're not quite sure whether it should be Turner or Fries or whatever, clearly he thinks it's Fries, but if you're not quite sure, this is a great opportunity to throw Turner into the fire and assess him in a World Cup game, which actually people might say there's nothing riding on it, but judging from Pochettino's culture and how he's been able to instantiate that Argentine winner mentality culture into this group where nothing is given, I'm sure that all the players who were on the field against Turkey were going 100%. They weren't cruise control at all because they also want to earn their place maybe in later matches. So I gave Pochettino a huge thumbs up when I saw the lineup come out. And I already kind of suspected that people were going to have an issue with him if the result wasn't there. So fast forward to the press conference, lo and behold, and I tuned in. First off, it's cringe AF, as always. I can't stand these reporters, these journalists. It's really bad. And we can get into the specifics of each one of them. Like the guy who tried to speak Spanish, I'm like, what are you doing, bro? Like, that's so bad. And there was no reason to try to speak Spanish. You literally speak English and Pochettino speaks English. But that aside, it's like, why are you criticizing the guy? It felt to me, Kirk, like a lot of the fan base, including these media folks, have been hearing over the past decade or two, we need to be more critical. We need to be more critical. We need to be more critical. We're too soft. The media is too soft. The fan base is too soft. And this was like maybe an opportunity for them to show we're not soft. We're hard, you know, and we're going to criticize the manager, even if we came top of the group, you know? So it felt like there was a sense of inauthenticity there. And this is not Pochettino's first time where he shows contempt for the media and their questions. And he showed a tremendous amount of contempt, which I give a huge thumbs up to. I was happy, man. I was laughing, but I was also pissed.
Yeah. No, I look, I'm right there with you. I think it was a poison chalice no matter what he did in this match. If things didn't go the way they were supposed to go, which to his point, right, the group is one. And he's like, you should be congratulating us. Like, we did something remarkable, right? We came out, we won back-to-back matches for the first time in the World Cup since 1930. So the first time ever, really, right? And he's like, just, you should be congratulatory, right? And so I like that he is there holding the line and be like, no, you guys don't get to do this. This is ridiculous what you're trying to do. Had he played starters and Tyler Adams picks up a yellow card and now you're going against Bosnia without him, right? Then the script would have been the exact same. What are you doing? You got it all wrong. Why would you risk this, right? But instead, it's just slightly different, right? You got this all wrong because now we lost momentum. But had that last goal not gone in the first place, it would have been like, this is the greatest group stage the U.S. has ever had. They're on 7 points. They were undefeated. They took it to Turkey with a B squad, right? A B squad that looked pretty shaky at times, and you still got the job done, right? And so for me, it was like, the result is meaningless, practically. Like, there's no change. Turkey's going home. You're going through. And it's also like they won in the last 20 seconds of the game. What are we doing here?
Yeah.
If you have something there, hop in. But
yeah, no, so many positives. You got what you wanted. You topped the group and you rested your guys who were on yellows, and you rested Pulisic, and you got to see the other guys in a real match.
Yeah.
And that gives also a lot of team cohesion in the locker room and everywhere else. Like, everybody now feels a part of it. Imagine if you play the starters again, and even if you win the game, and even if nobody gets a second yellow, even if everything went perfect, we beat Turkey 3-0 or something. Okay, but all the guys who didn't play in game one, didn't play in game two, or sparse minutes max, right? And now they also didn't play in game three, even though they could have, because it was a meaningless, in quotes, game. What does that do to what Americans like to say, the locker room, the morale of the players who are on the bench? No, you accomplished all goals by playing all those guys. Everybody's all smiles, team cohesion. You saw when Trusty scored the first goal, the bench, who were all the starters, were over the moon. You saw Pulisic, huge smile, Richard, huge smile. Everybody, it was a huge party. And even though they didn't get the result, I bet you that the quote-unquote locker room is fantastic.
Absolutely. The moment is tough, right? They try playing Country Roads again, which is like, don't do that after a loss, guys. Like, don't, not then. Like, I love that tradition. I think there's something like very authentic feeling about it. And just like, yeah, play some John Denver, everybody sing along when we win. But like, don't do it then. But I think, like you're saying, we did get a lot of good information. I think to your point about Turner and Freeze, right? You're getting to see, well, can they do it here? Are they in the right headspace? And I think a guy that you see that is clearly in the right headspace is Seb Berhalter, right? Receives a ton of hate, some of it deservedly so, some of it undeservedly, right? I think he comes in and he has a solid game, right? An assist and a goal, and he's active. He's not the greatest central midfielder. I think he is like, sometimes people will ask the question, like, what's a position that's obsolete now? And it's like the right midfielder in a 4-4-2. That, to me, that's Seb Berhalter, right? He's not a 360 player. He doesn't want to play. He shouldn't play in the middle, but the kid has some juice, and that he's fun to watch also when he scores. Like, he's hyped. He's ready to go. He's getting all the boys back together, and you can see him after the match too. Like, he's pissed that it doesn't go his way, right? And I want that in the team. And so you see that from him, where you also see guys like Mark McKenzie and Miles Robinson, Brendan Aaronson. Timo Weah had a terrible game. Ricardo Pepi got just absolutely bullied. And so you get some information like, we can't really use these guys down the stretch.
Let me hammer on that point, add to it, because some folks who don't like Pochettino, or some folks who are always looking to nitpick or be smart, they'll say, well, guys, if Pochettino doesn't know the players by now, like, what information does he get? Every single opportunity for a data point is invaluable. Yeah. You don't know a player 100%. Never. You can coach the same player for 8 years and not know the player 100%. This guy, as the national team manager, you rarely get your players, first and foremost, as a national team coach. And secondly, he's only been in the job for 18 months. And thirdly, the context of a World Cup is very different than the context of a friendly, is very different than the context of the Gold Cup or Nations League or whatever all these silly tournaments are. So you want to throw them in. And Turkey is a very different context than the other two teams that you had. So this was a brilliant data collection opportunity for Pochettino and his staff.
Yeah, I'm right there. I love this move. The only, like, to put a fine point on that, what does Scaloni do with Argentina a couple of days later, right?
Yeah.
No Messi. He comes in for 20 minutes. Of course, he gets a goal because he's
ridiculous.
He's that guy. It only takes a couple attempts for him. But he rests everybody, right? McAllister's on the bench. Right? Yeah, everybody's on the bench.
Yep.
And, you know, they have a much better result. They're playing Jordan. So it's not exactly the same. And they're a much better team and a much deeper team than the U.S. But, like, that's what the best teams in the world are doing, is they're resting guys. And so, like, that's how Poch is going to handle it. So all that is to say that we think he made the right decision, and the media freaks out because of the result, which is part of the problem, because they just don't understand. Like, they either don't understand or pretend not to understand. One of the weirdest things that I thought came out of all this is you have reporters going on podcasts and saying things. I can't remember who these guys, like Pittsburgh Soccer Now or something, came out and they said Poch in 18 months still doesn't understand the U.S. media and how it works. And they're apologizing for Paul Tenorio's question. They're saying he's asking him if he's concerned about a loss of momentum because he wants to give him a chance to say, no, we're all good. I have faith in my guys, right? And for me, when I hear that, I'm like, so you're just admitting that this whole thing is a farce, that, like you said earlier, the whole press conference is useless. Nobody's ever going to give it a legit answer. And they are surprised when Pochettino's like, no, I'll give you a legit answer. You guys are asking stupid questions. Because it's just supposed to be this, like, scripted WWE thing where I ask you this question and you respond with a silly response that doesn't mean anything.
Absolutely, man. It's all circus. It's all bread and circus. That's what really upsets me about the quote-unquote journalist, is you're not upholding the integrity of that profession. So what are you actually? Yeah, a journalist is supposed to be kind of like a serious thing. You're supposed to be kind of like an arbiter of truth, you know, an objective outside observer, you know, who's trying to accumulate key insights, you know, that maybe the public can't discern on their own, you know, so you go in there and that should be your objective, right? But it's not their objective. Like you, the example you just pointed out, they're literally trying to entice a certain narrative out of the manager, you know, it's
and they admit to it. They literally say he doesn't understand how the U.S. media works. And it's like, okay, well, you're admitting that the U.S. media is a farce, is a joke. Because you're just saying like, I give you the silly question and you give me the silly answer and we just move along and I write my little article. It's it's insane, Gary. It's insane to me that this is actually just out in the open at this point.
It's gross, man. It's gross. And I've been harping on this for many, many, many years because as you know, because you work in the space as well, when you work in the space, you start seeing this a lot more than when you don't work in the space. And then when you're bumping up against glass ceilings or trying to do pioneering work, you get even more friction from this precise sort of circus, you know, because it goes counter to the narrative that they've already deployed over years. And it, and if you don't fit into their narrative, into this little box, they don't like you. So Pochettino, for instance, hasn't been fitting into their nice, neat little box. Yeah. And so there's a lot of antagonism towards him. And you see this most prominently with like this guy that I call an imbecile. I apologize to your audience now, but I can't help myself, of Hercules Gomez. He has a stick up his butt, you know, with Argentinians and Argentina. I don't know why. I don't know where it comes from. Like, I think there's an insecurity complex there. Him being Mexican American or something, he has something in his mind. He goes against Tata Martino. He goes against Bielsa. He goes against Pochettino at every chance that he gets, you know. And so many of these folks had to bite their tongues after Paraguay and had to bite their tongues after Australia. And this was their little moment also to kind of have a little explosion. And they get attention as a consequence of that.
Right.
So they're in the attention game as opposed to in being journalist with integrity or report. By the way, what is the difference between a journalist and a reporter? Is there one?
The way I look at it is the people that are in that room are like beat reporters / journalists, right? The ones that are like trying to get information that the public doesn't have access to. Whereas like somebody like an anchor, and I want to get to this, I think her name is Abigail Velez, right? The girl that got in trouble from ABC7 in LA. I want to get to her too. She's like an anchor. Right. She's out there like telling a news story, but like somebody else did all the research for it or whatever. I don't know. That's how I see it.
Yeah,
I could be wrong.
Two more things. And we, if you want to move on, we can pull as much threads as you want. The counterfactual here is Germany. Germany played all its starters.
Yeah.
In their third match.
Yeah.
And what happened when they played all their starters? They lost. Mm-hmm. So what kind of a momentum situation do we have there? You literally played all your starters. And you lost. You lost the game.
Yeah.
What does that do to your team versus
and what
playing
does it do
your
to
benchers?
The opponents too? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like the opponent, like, here's the script. Here's what you like. Here are the notes. Everybody look at what Ecuador did and let's go do it. So I'm right there. Like you got to hide a little bit of what you do. I just don't see any negative, Gary. Like Pulisic looked awesome off the bench. He didn't score. He didn't assist, whatever. But like everything you needed to see from Turkey, you saw. Other than them defend one final play.
No negatives. No negatives. I don't see a negative at all. And look, and France, and here's the other case. France played all their starters again in their third match, and they won.
Yeah.
So, okay.
And
fine.
The funny thing there is Norway rested all theirs.
Correct. Well, think about what the media would have said here. If we had already kind of qualified, and we were up against France for our third match, and we played all our benchers, right? What would the media have said to Pochettino there?
Yeah. It's like we said earlier, right? The narratives were already pre-established.
Right. And look, Holland is a very early, Holland, right? Is a very good example of a proper soccer culture and a counter-establishment guy as well. Where they interviewed him after they had just won their second match. And they're like, hey, you're going up against France next. You know, he's like, I don't care. You know, like he literally said, we're probably going to lose and France is probably going to win the whole thing anyway. You know, so what does it matter? Like he has the same sort of level of contempt, right, for the people asking him the questions that Pochettino and that all the Bielsa and all people, in my opinion, Kirk, the people, the operators at the cutting edge of their craft, they know what this all is and they can't stand it.
Yeah. I think there's one more point, I think, here that goes, that like shows that this is a pre-established narrative, right? Because I think we've talked about this on one of the shows, you and I, before. One of my favorite all-time soccer memories is being in Qatar. We were at the Mall of Qatar watching the Argentina and Saudi Arabia match in 2022. And I'm there with my boys and my wife, and we kind of stumbled into this giant Saudi Arabian watch party. And we watched them take down Argentina, the eventual champs, right? And the party afterward was like the most insane thing, right? And I don't know if that moment was the thing that made Argentina win, but I don't think it hurt them to get kind of punched in the mouth early and stay humble, like where they have to stay humble and stay like, you can stomach a loss. And like, that could have easily been one of the narratives that came out, but because there's this testiness between the US media and Pochettino, it's like, no, 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 here's our chance to twist the knife. Like this is what we're going to do here.
So gross.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so gross. Okay, man. So Pochettino, I don't know if I have anything else to say about the Pochettino thing. Aside from maybe many, many years ago when Jurgen was the manager, I wrote many articles about what is the value of the national team coach, particularly here in the United States, because many people would say, well, if we just got the right manager, you know, we would do something spectacular. If we have the wrong... They think about it from a sporting perspective. And I'm like, guys, no matter if you get the best manager on planet Earth by a mile, you're not winning the World Cup, okay? Could you go one game further? Maybe. But you could also crash out in the group phase with Pep Guardiola as the coach, okay? So who knows? The main value from my vantage point is the guy has the biggest pulpit, the biggest microphone, and he can... I don't know, maneuver or kind of entice a cultural shift away from having a poor culture, a loser culture, a culture of mediocrity, a culture of this is all a circus, right? Towards a more serious culture, a culture of excellence, a culture of meritocracy, a culture of authenticity, a culture of, you know, let's be real here, guys. That is the primary role. From my vantage point, I believe it wholeheartedly. And that's what Pochettino's biggest value proposition is. And that's what he's bringing. But you see this immune response.
That's exactly what it is. It's an immune response. It's all the little antibodies like, no, 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 we can't have this. You're going to upset what we got going on here, right? As soon as that comes in, it's like, no, no, we have to attack it. And I agree. You saw it with Jurgen. You saw the opposite with Berhalter, where it was like, no, 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 we're going to protect this. Like, this is our thing. We have to protect this, right? Even if it means that we're going to stoke flames between him and the Reynas and whoever. Like, this isn't about choosing sides between Reyna and Berhalter. It's like, no, no, no. You can see how they rallied to protect their guy. And so I do think that's a big issue. And a big part of being the U.S. men's national team manager is helping to shift the culture. And I just wish the media... could just be more throughput, I guess, and not so obstinate about what they say. I don't know.
Where does it stem from? Do you think it's an issue of insecurity of the members of the media? Do you think it's a thing of incentives where, meaning they actually do know football and they actually do know what's going on and stuff, but the incentives because of their employer, and so they go this particular direction? Is it a mixture of insecurity and that? Like, what's going on?
I think it's a lot of insecurity. And like you alluded to, like, I think it has a lot to do with an inferiority complex where this is like the one sport where the U.S. can't get together, right? Anytime the World Cup comes around, we always fight the same battles. Oh, if our best athletes just played soccer from a young age, everything would be different. Because look at how dominant the U.S. is in the Olympics. And it's like, there's more to it than that, right? We fight the same battles over and over and over because everybody just expects us to be the best. Because that is like uniquely American, this idea of like, no, we are exceptional and we're going to do this our way. And it just hasn't proven to be the case at all with soccer. And for whatever reason, we are super allergic to asking for help or just being humble about like, maybe there's a better way to do this thing, right? And you see that probably most in the way that MLS is covered and handled and operated, where it's insiders only. That's it. You have to be an insider. And then once you are inside, you do everything you can to protect the castle. I don't know. I think it's probably that simple.
Yeah. Because it's really weird. There's not one I can point to and be like, that guy's real. Like, that guy is legit. Like, that is the Marcelo Bielsa of American soccer media. Or that, you know what I mean? Not even one guy.
I'm trying to think of one that kind of breaks the mold, whether it's a coach or, you know, somebody at U.S. soccer or a journalist. I mean, you just talked to him a while ago. I think Tab Ramos is probably one of the closer, like, he has a unique voice that he's still, like, he's himself, right? He's unapologetically Tab, and he's going to do his thing. And as far as journalists, I think they're all kind of tainted at this point. It sounds way more accusatory and inflammatory than I mean it. But they all depend on MLS and U.S. soccer for their access. And that's their livelihood. So I don't know. There's really just not very many independent voices that really carry through all the noise.
It's really flagrant and obvious if you pay any attention. They all protect each other, too. And they all distribute each other's content. And
right.
Anybody outside the castle, as you put it, they don't protect. And in fact, they attack and they don't distribute their content. You've heard the expression many times, right? The football is an expression of or a reflection of its society, right? So how this is not obviously confined to American soccer, right? It expands to our national media, our state level media, our city level media, like extended beyond soccer and even the other sports. I'm sure there's a lot of the similarities to what's happening.
Right. And I think you do see that. And I've lived in a lot of cities over the past 24 years since I left LA. And it's been interesting to watch like every city's like local sports media cover their teams, who the fans rally around and who they really don't like. Like, so I lived in Cleveland for a few years and watching those beat reporters, like there were a couple that had access straight to the ownership group that would always be doing like puff reports and interviews with people that the owners really wanted to push, right? And it was kind of like the local talk radio that would really fan the flames when things were bad, as all these kind of like local beat reporters would try and again, protect the castle. It's been a long time since I've been around the LA media, so I don't really know. But like, it's like, I think there are pockets of that, like that sort of protectionist mindset in any American sport. And soccer is just so incestuous in this country because it's all run by one company, MLS, that they're all inside the same castle.
Yeah, and as evidence, because on paper, different media outlets should be competing against one another, right? You're competing for the eyeballs and attention and credibility against one another. And yet you see a behavior that's the antithesis of that, right? They all support one another. Really strange. Right. And people might say, well, Gary, isn't that like a great thing? You know, we're all together in this. Well, but it shows that there's something fishy going on because you're different entities and you're competing for the same dollar. Right? Attention.
Yeah.
And if you're not doing that, then that should raise some question marks.
Right. And there is something, again, I sort of cover LAFC, right, from like an outsider position. There's something about everybody is willing to help out the little guy because I feel like everybody feels like they're the little guy. It's always a podcast or like a Substack or something. It's not, they don't work for ESPN. Typically, right? Those are all kind of like freelance people that ESPN uses for their articles or whatever. And nobody reads that stuff anyway, so it doesn't really matter. So I think what it is it's a lot of podcasts. And so it is like a guy like me just sitting in his room. And it's like, if somebody reaches out to me and is like, hey, how did you start an LAFC podcast and whatever? I'll be like, yeah, I'll sit down with you. So like, there isn't really a need to compete because I think a lot of it is a bit amateur. Like that's like, I cover the sport as an amateur, right? MLS, that is, right? And so like I think there is something, there is like a unique collaboration there that prevents that internal competition too.
But if we're referring to the folks who are in the press conferences with Pochettino,
right,
that level, like they're all literally paid salaries and they're all different media outlets that actually have, you know, businesses, profitable businesses that they're trying to protect and expand. But I understand what you're, where you're coming from. But if the context is Pochettino or like this sort of space, you still don't see ferocious competition or any competition.
No, it's all kind of like you know, a lot of the guys write for The Athletic or ESPN or whoever. I guess The Athletic is New York Times now, right? Do I have that right?
Yeah.
But there's not very much. And at one time, they all wrote for MLS.
And they'll help the little guy also for two reasons. One, they don't see you as a threat, you know, initially.
Right.
And secondly, they'll help you if you fall in line, so long as you fall in line, right?
Yeah.
Because if you don't fall in line, then they are not going to help you.
I think that's the key, right? There is a narrative. There's a set of core beliefs, you could call it, right? MLS is good for American soccer. You have to be on board with that. There's like a set of politics that you have to have to cover the sport and like gain traction, right? There's a lot of different things that you, there's a lot of little boxes that you have to tick along the way to make sure that you're one of the group. And maybe that's a good point to bring up Marcelo Bielsa, who everybody knows he's prickly. He has a set of principles that he's stuck to forever, and the best soccer minds in the world adore him for it. And a lot of people, and I would generally lump them in as like weak soccer minds, hate him for it. He's talked a lot about MLS and about U.S. soccer, and these people have long enough memories to hate him for it. And so watching them talk about Uruguay crashing out with glee because this was their chance to skewer Marcelo Bielsa is, again, really telling of like these narratives already wrote themselves and you guys were just waiting for this to happen.
I want to get down a little bit or attempt to get down to the root of the Bielsa thing. There's a lot of parallels with Pochettino, but it goes further. First, I want to mention that I've been following Marcelo Bielsa for close to 30 years, okay, and closely. So as a child, I would not only watch his teams play, most notably, I started doing this in 2002, before 2002, when he first got the Argentine national team, okay? And we had VHS recorders, so this takes you back in time, and we recorded all the matches, and me and my brother would deconstruct all the matches. So what you see people doing analysis now, right, when they talk about, you know, 4-4-2 diamond and this guy had these relationships with the outside back and, you know, here's the transition from offense to defense or here's the transition from a 3 in the back to a 4 in the back and all the stuff that you see Americans, some American soccer analysts currently doing the past 5 years, I was doing that as a teenager, you know, completely deconstructing Marcelo Bielsa. And that has transpired for decades now.
Yeah.
So I just want to share that little tidbit to hopefully gain a little bit of credence, you know, with what I'm saying. When folks say that he is a genius and, you know, and I don't want to appeal to authority, but like a Pep Guardiola, like a Pochettino, like a Luis Enrique, like all these managers that he's touched, his coaching tree, and his former players, that he is an absolute genius, there's a reason for that. And from my vantage point, I always saw clean structure happening with his teams way back in the late 90s up to modern day. And it seemed revolutionary because when I was attempting to deconstruct other teams, other national teams, it looked like I couldn't see patterns. It was a bunch of chaos.
Yeah.
Just chaos all over the place. Okay. Like pickup soccer. So it seemed like the managers back then were more man managers and like picking the right guys, seeing who's in form, who's not in form, and very rudimentary first order system of play. But Bielsa would go like 5 layers deep. And I think that was very influential in football. And I think he still does that to this day. I truly believe that the guy is an outlier when it comes to football. And why people hate him, or the media, I should rather say, I think in large part, it's not the sporting side. I think it's large part, he seems like such a man of principles outside of football. Like he's an incredibly honest person, a person with pristine integrity, a person which will sacrifice himself at the altar ahead of others. Like all the things that you would say, wow, what an extraordinary human being this man is. I think it's an affront to those of us who aren't as good of a human. So, and we don't like it, you know, we don't like it. Like, how can you be such a remarkable human person?
Yeah.
I that might seem like way out there to the audience, but I truly believe that to be the case.
There is so much that has come from him that it's almost easy. But, you know, there's a phrase in Spanish, right? A la mata de espina no se tira la piedra, right? So you don't throw the rock at a tree of thorns. You throw it at a tree full of mangoes, right? Like that's the idea. And there's a lot of mangoes on the Marcelo Bielsa tree, right? You could name coaches. You could name style of play. You could name all sorts of different things. The way he's handled the media, the way he thinks about the game, how obsessive he is about the game itself, that it's easy. Like, that's where you throw the rocks, right? Oh, this guy's too gruff, or he hates the media. He hates his players. He runs his players into the ground, whatever it is. But the man has revolutionized the sport, not only himself, but through his disciples too, right? The biggest one being Pep, obviously. But everywhere you look, there's his disciples at the top levels of the game. Pochettino's one. You mentioned Luis Enrique, right? Matias Almeida, right? Like, you can just go down the list of all these coaches everywhere throughout the world that have been influenced by him. And he had the misfortune of saying a few bad things about MLS. Oh, it makes players lazy or whatever, right? Or I'm not going to call in guys that are in MLS. There was a big one. It was LAFC related, because there was a guy named Kike Oliveira at LAFC who was he's just a hustle merchant. That's all he is. He's a pacey winger. When he went to LAFC, everybody just said, oh, he's got elite speed. He's got Premier League speed. This is what he has. But like, the dude was a terrible decision maker, terrible finisher, couldn't play make on the move. And at some point, Bielsa said, like, we're not going to call him in because, like, he's too lazy. MLS has made him lazy. And as soon as that whistle blew against Spain, I saw LAFC accounts, MLS reporters, whatever, like, oh, I guess you need more MLS players or whatever. And that's something that I want to get into too, like the way that they talk about all these things and how it's a fallacy on its own. But he's just said the wrong thing a few too many times. And we've seen this from him before, right? I think it was in England. Was it in England that he did like the 2-hour like slideshow presentation at a press conference, right? Was it? I don't remember where it was. And it's like this famous example. I'll have to look it up and figure it out. But the guy's an encyclopedia. And he's like, it is weird to see just how gleeful everybody is to see Uruguay fail, because it's just presumed that it's his fault, not even on the Uruguayan players themselves. Which I don't, Uruguay to me doesn't seem like the team to play Bielsa ball with, for lack of a better term. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, a little bit of history too, because people here in the United States live in a bubble. And when they look at Bielsa's history, they're not looking at it like I looked at it, right? They're just looking up on Wikipedia and what teams did he coach and what was his record. That's literally the analysis that the typical American does. And the typical American, most probably don't speak Spanish also, so it's hard to even listen to the guy in press conferences. And yes, nowadays there's some translations out there for some press conferences, which is helpful. But that, just to put that in important context, the guy, wherever he has gone, he has left an impressionable mark in a positive respect, but a remarkable mark. So in Argentina, when he took over Newell's Old Boys and won with Newell's Old Boys, they literally named the freaking stadium after the guy.
Yeah.
Okay. That was the beginning of his career. When he goes to Athletic Bilbao, small club in Spain, only gets players from the Bilbao region. So you can't go and purchase whoever you want or anything. No.
Right.
He took that team to peaks it had never experienced before. And I think I already forget, right? They beat Manchester United in Europa League or I don't even remember anymore, but he handed Alex Ferguson his ass, you know, with Athletic Bilbao against Manchester United. And Ferguson admitted, you know, this is ridiculous what this man has accomplished. Goes to Leeds. He's a legend at Leeds.
He's a saint.
The entire city idolized the guy. Okay. And by the way, when he leaves these clubs or these teams, the legacy kind of continues, right? And it grows. Like, he leaves the clubs in a better state than he left them at, or national teams. I'll get to the national teams in a second, because in Chile, he did remarkable work in Chile.
Yeah.
Chile accomplished things never before in its history was able to accomplish. And he elevated players to levels of European football because he made them, right? Elevated them, platformed them, made them who they are. Never before seen for a Chilean player, whether it's Vidal, whether it's, you know, that whole cohort. And he leaves Chile. And what does Chile go on to do with that same cohort and with his successors? They go on to win two Copa Americas, defeating Argentina. But it continues, right? Because he goes to freaking Uruguay, this Uruguay now, if we want to go to present day, through the elimination process, they were accomplishing things Uruguay never really accomplished. He wiped his ass with Argentina 2-0 in the Bombonera, Boca Stadium. Messi was playing. Everybody was playing. It was, you know what the Bombonera is. He wins. He beats Brazil also in the qualification process. He qualifies very highly on the table. He was killing it. And I don't know, I'm not in the locker room, but it seems like there were issues, right, when it came to Luis Suarez. Luis Suarez not a starter. Luis Suarez not being called up. Luis Suarez is not important anymore, you know, and he's not going to call Luis Suarez to the World Cup. Shit happens, you know, and the locker room is lost. Our locker room is broken. Valverde is like, fuck this guy. I'm not going to do what he says anymore. And this is the result that you get. That's my interpretation of it. I don't know if it's right or wrong.
We're probably too close to it at this point. I'm sure more will come out and we'll get. But I mean, one thing that you look at is that, like, it's not the same Uruguay as it was 7 or 8 years ago, right? He's able to get some good stuff out of them. There are clearly problems in the locker room where at the end of that match, it's like they're more concerned about just taking it to Spain and taking out their frustrations than they are about really like scoring a goal to try and stay alive. There are clearly some problems there. And whether that's his fault or somebody else, I don't know. We may know, we may find out eventually, we may never know. It's probably never going to be crystal clear. But this idea of him leaving legacies everywhere he goes is 100% the truth, right? And so to try and just write all that off because he was mean to MLS it's insane, right? And this goes back to your point about Pochettino, right? There's discussion about him being retained by, you know, he was offered an extension. I don't know if he should take it, if he would be interested. I don't know if it's the right move. I'm typically not a huge 2 World Cup like term guy, but in the sense that Pochettino is the kind of guy that can help fix the culture if he's not attacked by this autoimmune disease that U.S. soccer has. I would pay the price of admission for that because hopefully he could finally get through it, everybody. I don't think that's possible. I don't see how you get past this media blockade, really.
Yeah, a couple of things. The immune response happens to former coaches that coached in MLS, right? If they say anything bad about the league, they trash the guy, okay?
Yeah.
Or players. Zlatan Ibrahimovic, the most recent famous one, he's like, MLS, fucking this is shit. There's no pressure. It's a joke. The fans here are soft. I'm sure you've seen this. This happened within the past several weeks or something. And what do the media folks here? They trash the guy, right? I thought we were in the business of discovering truth, right? Journalists, you know what I'm saying? Why take a position and trash the guy instead of simply reporting what the guy said? Simply report what the guy said. That's what a journalist does. And by the way, when Pochettino now, when the World Cup started, he said that MLS is not good because there's no promotion relegation and American sports creates a loser mentality. And what happened, Kirk? What happened was that only us little independent outlets spread that. The main media guys, the main outlets, the mainstream, did not a peep. I did not see the mainstream spray that everywhere. Now, if Pochettino had said, oh, MLS is phenomenal, thank God for MLS, that's why we're having so much success, they would have spread, they'd still be spreading it right now.
I mean, they in a way are, because when he calls up somebody like Christian Roldan, the MLS accounts are almost immediately tweeting it out. Like, see, Christian Roldan's the guy. He's the guy. They'll pimp whoever, like whichever MLS player happens to be doing something at that moment, they will hit it as hard as they can. And I don't necessarily blame them. because they're all invested in this thing called MLS, right? It's not like a regular sporting organization. It's about getting more eyeballs to it. We're all in the same, it's back to that same thing. We're all in this together. We're all trying to grow the sport, but we're going to grow it our way. So don't step out of line.
And for us.
It's not only a homogenous approach to covering the game, it's a homogenous like view of the game itself and also a homogenous worldview. It's, you can see things one way and that's everything. Again, go back to the politics thing. It's like a very set of politics that you have to have to do it. And it's very homogenous is what it is.
No, and it goes, and people nowadays, the kids say, it's not that deep, bro, or whatever. Yeah. No, it actually is that fucking deep, bro. Yeah. You just don't have a job in the business world necessarily. You don't understand the machinery, right? Or the system of incentives that exist in different industries or sectors, which leads me, because you brought up Pochettino being offered a renewal, apparently, and The Athletic reporting, oh, Pochettino, U.S. Soccer has extended, you know, an offer or something like that. Nobody looks at the real incentives or possibilities. And it's not a conspiracy. This is just how business works. Notice that it didn't come out what they offered him, right? They could have offered him a shockingly bad contract. And for negotiating purposes, because that's what you want to do when you negotiate, you know, or whatever. No, they could have done a shockingly bad offer so that the guy rejects it. And then from a public perception perspective, it's like, well, we tried, guys. We tried to get him back, you know, but he said no. See, this is how reporters and journalists lie. They lie by omission. They don't actually tell you, right, what the terms of the contract were. For example, in this scenario, they'll just say, hey, U.S. Soccer offered him something. He rejected it. We tried to do the right thing. The guy wanted to move on. What can we do? Let's bring on your LAFC boy that has no job right now. What's his name again?
Cherundolo. Steve Cherundolo.
Let's bring on Cherundolo.
We can talk about that.
Let's bring on Wilfred Nancy or something.
So I think this point is really good, though, because it kind of lays bare the fact that this is a corporate way of handling things, right? We made him an offer. We made him a qualifying offer. The guy didn't want it, right? Mm-hmm. 3 months ago, when there was a report out that he was talking to AC Milan, they were all up in arms. See, he doesn't even care about the World Cup. He doesn't care. 1 foot out the door already. This is going to be a disaster, right? They were already setting the narratives in place to skewer him. And now that the US has seen some success, it's like, oh, just kidding. We offered him an extension. Of course, we're not going to pay him $6 million again. That's insane. So it was a lower offer for 4 years, but he rejected us. He didn't want to be here, like we said all along.
Yeah, and then they can start their 18-month search.
I mean, even so, that's another point about, again, it's all very corporate, right? When they rehired Greg Berhalter, they kept saying, we hired this outside consulting agency that helped us put together metrics on what would make the team successful. And when we ran everything, it turned out that Greg Berhalter, this is legit. I've tweeted about this several times, right? With all the articles in the replies, Greg Berhalter was the guy that met all those metrics. It's like, well, you guys set the metrics so you could get the outcome you wanted. It's why nobody ever rejects their hypothesis in academic literature anymore, right? Everybody sets the parameters ahead of time so they can meet them and they can look smart. Like, oh, see, we settled on the right guy. We had the right hypothesis all along. And that's how it all operates.
It's kind of sad. It's an insight into they think that the people are stupid.
Yeah. I think to an extent they are.
No. Don't get me started. Well, of course. And one of the narratives that makes everything okay is that, guys, it's not that deep. This is just entertainment. Like,
yeah.
Why are you taking it so serious? It's just entertainment. There's more important things in life. Well, yes. With that narrative, you give the green card for the monopoly to do whatever the hell it wants, because it's not that big a deal, guys. There's more important things in life. Well, what you fail to recognize is that there are real lives in the space, in the ecosystem. There are real jobs. There are real businesses. There are real children, you know, that are affected by all of these sorts of things. Real communities that are affected by all these sorts of things. So it's not just a game, because you can say it's just wine, or it's just the computer industry, or it's just glassware, or it's just freaking, I don't know, construction, or it's just plumbing. You can say that to just about anything. And then what kind of a society do we have?
You're going to have to help me out there. I'm not.
Well, because, okay. So then what matters is what I'm saying. What are we going to agree on that actually matters?
Right.
Because I'll tell you what, for pipes and the quality of pipes and the brackets and the welding and all, that really fucking matters to a plumber, really fucking matters to a homeowner, which really matters to, there's a whole cascade effect where it really fucking matters.
Right. Now I see what you're saying. Now, if we just say nothing, none of this matters, it's kind of a nihilistic way of looking at everything and just saying, well, it doesn't matter anyway, so who cares? It's like, well, if the building's not sound, then it's going to fall and people are going to be impacted. So this is kind of skirting one of the topics that I wanted to get into, and I kind of alluded to it with the way that MLS people talk about MLS players. Are you familiar with the Mott and Bailey fallacy?
No.
So Mott and Bailey is a type, we're going to go back to the castle analogy. I didn't plan for this, but so it's a type of castle. The Bailey is like, imagine like a bunch of farmland with a fence around it. And then the Mott is like a fortified castle inside that Bailey. And so the fallacy is you have a position that is hard to defend and controversial, and then which would be the Bailey. And then you have a very defensible position inside the Mott. And so you venture out into the Bailey and you say things like Christian Roldan is clearly better than any other midfielder because he plays in MLS and Seattle, you know, is the best team in MLS or whatever it is, right? And that is meant to be provocative. It's meant to be engagement bait, right? And then as soon as people start to come with real analysis where it's like, hey, well, this guy, like, he really can't hold on to the ball. He doesn't play 360 degrees. He can't create. He's got 50 caps or something for the US and has never scored a goal and has zero assists. And all of a sudden they retreat to the Mott part of the argument. And they're like, guys, it's not that deep, like you're saying, right? It's just, this is all for vibes. That's all this ever was, right? And so they make these provocative statements and arguments and then retreat, and they make them. And I think you see this in US politics all the time. Kind of like you said, like the soccer reflects the entire landscape here. And I see this as the way that the U.S. covers soccer as well, whereas it's always this really grandiose claim and then everybody retreats back to the Mott. And typically that Mott argument is, guys, relax. We all actually know that Leo Messi is a world-class superstar and that MLS didn't make him. We know that. But anyway.
No. I had heard of it. I just never use it in everyday language, but I had heard of that. I'm thinking where I heard of that first. I think it was very recent, within the past year, because I listened to the All In podcast. I don't know if you listen to the All In podcast at all. It's four guys. They're very wealthy, entrepreneurs, venture capitalists. One of them's in the Trump's cabinet or whatever. And I learned a lot of things, and I think I heard it there first, because like you said, it happens in the broader national conversation when it comes to national politics, and they do the same thing. The journalists will do the same thing. The reporters will do the same thing. Media personalities do the same thing. It's really annoying, and I don't think there's any escaping it at all. I think this is probably something that goes to the beginning of time, Kirk. It's just a tactic of rhetoric, I suppose. And I think that's why they hate Bielsa. I think that because he doesn't play that game, he doesn't do that, and he doesn't let them do it to him.
Right. Yeah, no, he's a man of substance. Just like, again, back to the start of this conversation, Pochettino would probably give a great response if the question had any substance to it. But that's not what the media is there for.
No, so two more things, because you wanted to bring it up to the girl, because it applies to the girl reporter where is Bosnia Herzegovina, who gives a shit or whatever. They're doing it now. It's like, they're also saying, whoa, why are you, come on. At the end of the day, it's just the game.
Why would you ever talk trash? Like, this is such a despicable thing to do. But then you go to their timeline and it's nothing but like talking trash and smack about other teams in the World Cup. It's like, guys, do you not see?
And you saw, I try not to spend too much time. I definitely don't read long form articles that these people write.
Sure.
I think it's a waste of my time. So once the headlines come across my timeline, obviously, so I'm aware of things, where there was this huge backlash against Alexi Lalas led by Zlatan Ibrahimovic, right? And everybody's anti-Alexi, and the immune response is trying to protect him too now.
Right. Alexi's an interesting one, especially to this conversation too, because I still think people don't get what he does. Mm. Like, Alexi Lawless is just a wrestling heel. That's all he is. It's like a conscious decision to be 100% pro-America in whatever venue. And if that makes me a villain, even better, right? Mm-hmm. Because your clicks are going to turn into eyeballs on my show, on my podcast or whatever. I don't think there's a whole lot of depth to any of his commentary or anything, but like, he's just a heel. That's all he is. And people are just up in arms about it all the time. And it is disingenuous. It's a disingenuous way to cover the game, but he's one of the biggest and loudest voices, I think. And I think you see Landon Donovan going the same direction, where it's just like, he's making all these controversial statements and kind of using his national team career as the platform. And then what do you see him doing next? FanDuel ads on Twitter. So it's like, guys, it's all just kind of a scheme. It's all just a ruse. It really is a circus. And again, that's what's so offensive to me, I guess, is that like, these are the people that should be helping us build this culture, or empowering voices that are going to help us build the culture. And all they're interested in is like, no, Pochettino wants to say something real. Tear that man to the ground. Like, take him down to the studs. We don't want him in here.
Yeah. I think what really disturbs me are two things. One is, I think they actually cause harm to the ecosystem.
Yeah.
By doing this. And principally through people who are new to the ecosystem, new to the sport. They don't know who's who, what's what, who's credible, who's not credible, what is real, what's a show or a circus, you know, or an act or a disingenuous rant. And you're getting into these people's minds and you're molding their minds in a certain direction. And next thing you know, you've got a brand new cohort of 1 million soccer parents or soccer fans or whatever, who have effectively been brainwashed by these people. And so we never graduate, Kirk, if this continues. And the second reason that I can't stand these folks is I find it just utterly offensive that, I don't know how, I can't wrap my head around how can a human live like they do? I want to be optimistic about humanity, right? I want to be optimistic that everybody wants to do the right thing and everybody's a good person and you have these principles or a code of ethics or a code of integrity and you want to live in that sort of way, but they show the exact opposite of that. And I find it repulsive. You know, something happens to me physically even where I see somebody consciously, like you said, say, nah, 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 I don't care about integrity. I don't care about all those things. I'm just going to play this character.
Right.
Like, I don't know how they live with themselves.
Yeah, because at that point, you're an actor, like, just filling a role. And there's, again, no meaning to it. There's nothing there worthwhile. And it does seem like a hollow way to go about life, I guess. It's weird. One thing you said, Gary, that really, you started to talk about it, like, there's real impacts. Like, there are tangible impacts to this. It's not just a sport. It's something else. And I think people can hear that and be like, ah, but it really is just a game. And it's like, well, no, because now you're talking about kids trying to make their way. They see themselves in the World Cup in 14 years. That's where they want to be, right? And Americans are kind of obsessed with this. Is this going to be the World Cup that really pushes the sport over, like, over the hill and helps us, like, really build something? And the answer is no, it's not. It could be a cultural moment where a lot of kids get interested, but until they come up against those glass ceilings that you've talked about, both on your show, on this show, at 100 different times, that's when they start to actually feel impacted. And that's when people are gonna speak out. And I want to put a fine point on this, because people have to understand. So if you're getting into the World Cup right now, like, this has piqued your interest and your kids are watching and all of a sudden they want a soccer ball and they're out there playing in the backyard. What MLS has done to US soccer by monopolizing the entire thing from top to bottom, including the youth game, is making it that much harder for your kid to succeed at the sport, for your kid to actually reach the level that you're watching on TV right now, because they have a monopoly on the first division. They have a monopoly on all the talent in the US. They have a monopoly on the pathway, and they keep monopolizing the youth game more and more, right? Where now they have the top the quote unquote top division. It's meaningless because it's not an actual pyramid, but they have the again, quote unquote top division in the youth game. And now they are trying to cannibalize more youth leagues by creating MLS 2. And what they will say, the defensible position, right, is no, we're trying to grow the game. We're doing everything we can. We're investing all this money into the game. Like, that's what we're doing here. But what they're really doing is they're just cannibalizing everything that has happened before. And if you're not with them, you're against them. That's like the Bailey part of the argument, I guess. And until you see that personally with your own eyes, I don't think it's clear. So unfortunately, we're like, if we have this mass movement of 30 million soccer families in the U.S. or 30 million families all of a sudden become soccer families, it's going to take them 7 or 8 years to realize, oh, these guys are holding my kids back. And so then you reset the clock another 12 years. So it's a long timeline. It's a long war, Gary. Sorry, that was a long rant there.
No. I think we as a community who do see it have done a terrible job of communicating this. I find I'm very culpable because the people at the top are very smart. When people start getting mad because they're seeing there's something wrong, they say, oh, it's because U.S. soccer is dumb or MLS is dumb.
Yeah.
They're not dumb.
Yeah.
They're very intelligent. They've architected this whole thing so that they can concentrate power and wealth to themselves. And they've executed flawlessly on doing that. That's a very intelligent things that they've been doing.
Sophisticated.
And they continue to do it. It's very sophisticated. So our only sort of way in is to maybe educate the parents because they are the most numerous and they are the ones with their wallets early enough, right? And at scale so that there's a fighting chance to have some sort of revolt or revolution. How that manifests is a whole conversation unto its own, very challenging as well. But the in is through pay to play, right? Because that's where parents first start wondering and questioning. And the existing mainstream narrative, like if they want to explore this, the existing mainstream narrative immunizes the monopoly, right, from the pay to play conundrum, okay? Because they separate, no, MLS, the monopoly is over here, right? They're the pros. Yeah. And it's the entire youth ecosystem that's separate from us that is a cancer or the problem.
It's the greedy clubs and coaches.
Greedy clubs, greedy coaches. We're the good guys over here. And we're just trying to make soccer work, make it popular because it's not popular in the United States. That's the whole narrative. And there's a lot of logic to it, especially for people who don't know any better and won't know any better for 10 years, that is nonsense. And so they fall into this trap. And now the enemies are the youth coaches. The enemies are the youth clubs. The enemies are the youth associations. The enemies are the youth leagues. So what we need to get through to these folks is the reason that pay to play exists at the scale it exists and at the magnitude that it exists is because the professional game has been monopolized. There's no promotion relegation. Okay.
Yeah.
That's step number one. Now, why is that the case? Because if you had an open ecosystem at the professional level, we would have way more professional clubs throughout the country in every nook and cranny of the country at whatever division it happens to be. It could be division 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I don't know. Look at the English pyramid. The English pyramid has 8 to 10 divisions, right? With senior teams on it. And England is the size of California, right? And we have a way bigger thing going on here and more money. So if we had an open ecosystem, you would have thousands of quote unquote pro teams somewhere in the pyramid. And what is their incentive now in their own respective regions? Their incentive is to develop the youth in their respective regions and not create a barrier, an economic barrier for the best players to participate in. And also they want the best players. So they want to create a meritocracy at the youth system. And so to filter appropriately who are the better players. So you would have promotion relegation throughout the youth ecosystem with everybody aligned with player development, as opposed to what exists now. Since there is no promotion relegation, there are no senior teams for your youth club. So they're only youth clubs. They're businesses. They need to survive. How do they survive? Where are they going to get their money from? It's not going to be from a senior team. They don't have a senior team.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be through sponsorships or TV deals or the city because there's no senior team. So the customer is the parent.
Yep.
So we have to charge the parents and we have to charge them as much as we possibly can, right? To operate the business. And by the way, nobody's getting rich. The clubs aren't getting rich off this. They're barely operating. And the coaches aren't getting rich. The coaches are making $20,000 a year, $40,000 a year. Maximum, maybe an outlier is making six figures, which is just like a regular job out in another sector of the economy. They are not villains in all this. So that's step one, Kirk. We really have to get that story out there at scale for people to recognize it.
Yeah, completely agree. I think this is where it all clicks into place because the promotion relegation argument that's made and that's kind of like straw-manned by MLS media is that the games in MLS don't matter because there's never a penalty. It's like, no, the games don't matter in MLS because they're all the same organization. They're all going to stay in the same league. It doesn't really matter who wins at the end because everybody's going to, you know, retain their job and all the players are making money. The coaches are making money. Everybody's happy, right? That's it. That's the end of it. There's never any innovation. There's nobody else coming up through the ranks. There's no other team that's doing something new and unique with new and unique players that's going to threaten any of that because it's all locked out. And so that it's like, I don't know, the media really does straw man pro rel. It's like the threat of being relegated is the worst thing ever. And that's what's going to add pressure to the games, which is not the case. There is that, right? It does, like, relegation does hurt and teams and clubs will do everything they can to avoid it. But that's not the point. The point is the youth game and feeding, like, every single club across the country feeding into a first team that is in a legitimate competition. So, like, here in Arizona, NPSL, I think it's called, is not a legitimate competition. Nobody cares. Nobody ever will. You could say the same about USL. Mm-hmm. And Americans will say the same thing. Nobody watches minor league baseball. Yeah, because it's literally the minor leagues. Nobody's ever going up or down except for players here or there, right? It's not a legitimate competition because there's no reward or incentive at the end for any of those teams. Whereas if you have a legit pyramid, yes, the second or third or fourth division are a lower level, but like for a guy like me in Flagstaff, the fact that it's part of a legitimate, like whatever the Flagstaff team is called, the Flagstaff Thunderbirds or whatever you want to call, I don't care. The fact that they are in a legitimate league could, yes, get relegated or promoted, and that my kid, when he joins their academy, has a chance at their first team and can be seen by legitimate professionals all over the country or all over the region or wherever, like that's what legitimizes the whole thing. And I don't know how to make it any easier for people to see that. It does seem like you have to have a kid in the system that is getting hosed before you're like, bro, this is nonsense. We can't do it this way anymore. I don't know. Is there something we're missing? Is there another way to explain this to people? I don't know, Gary.
I think it's difficult also because, and with all respect, I think our education system at large does a terrible job of educating people. And you have people who graduate elementary school, high school, bachelor's degree, master's degree, like at all levels, and come out mathematically illiterate, statistically illiterate, economically illiterate, financially illiterate. You have a bunch of folks who have no concept of the machinery that is the world.
Right.
You know,
and we spend more per capita on education than anybody.
Yeah.
By a long ways. Yeah.
So it's really tough to get people to understand the first, second, third order effects of an economic system, right? So they just see pro rel, promotion relegation, as some sort of competition format, you know?
Yes.
Period. Like, period, end of story. Competition format. Like, they're utterly incapable of going deeper than that. And if you try to go deeper than that, it's very challenging for them because you need some base level computational power up here. I don't know, to really start putting the puzzle pieces together. It's difficult. How do you talk about free market economics versus, you know, closed market economics? How do you talk to people about what money actually is? How do you talk to people what power actually means? How do you talk to people what incentives actually are? You know, they kind of get that stuff, but in a very rudimentary, not sophisticated enough to really go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Well, I just believe that.
I agree. And this goes back to our point about, like, to understand it, you have to go through all this analysis and wonky math, and like, you have to understand all the machinations behind the process. And it's like, what I really want to do is I want to go have a hot dog at a game and watch some soccer with my kid. Go back to the, it's not that deep, bro, right? Like, that's, in some ways, like, that's enough for most people. And I don't necessarily blame them for that, for just wanting to go and be entertained, right?
And they're very busy. They're very busy. They have full-time jobs, they have families, and who knows what kind of fires they have to put out. Maybe their parents are ill, or you don't have fucking time to go through all of this. And,
right.
But that's how they get away with it. And not just how the monopoly gets away with it. The government at a national or state level gets away with the stuff that they get away with, because the population is too busy and they don't feel enough pain yet to really revolt. You know what I'm saying? We're starting to feel pain, but I don't know what that threshold is before people break. And they're like, you know what? Let's whip out the guillotine.
Yeah. And I mean, we can bring it back to Landon one more time. Like, Landon is feeling pain. When I watch these interviews with Landon right now, and he's talking about his 8-year-old kid in a tough spot, and it's like, I know that. I know that feeling. I know that parent. I know the parent that you are, because I was that parent 10 years ago looking at clubs in my city and being like, bro, I'm not doing this. I'm not paying for this product. I'm just not. And so in some ways, it's very sympathetic and almost heartwarming to see even somebody like Landon Donovan, like, coming to grips with this. And I just pray to God that he, like, makes the right conclusions. He's probably got too many of the wrong voices in his ear, though, to come to the right conclusions.
But that's the other challenge, right? Is that Landon is completely indoctrinated in the monopoly, that he's been swimming in the monopoly for decades. That is his mental model. That is his
monopoly
worldview.
Made him. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, how do you break out of that? And so when we're talking about how do we educate parents and, you know, things of that nature who aren't Landon Donovan, haven't been swimming in that pool. Well, we have a fighting chance early on, and we also have a fighting chance when they're feeling pain. But since the mainstream, and it goes back to the media full circle again, since the mainstream media has been cold, you know, to be monolithic and spread the monopoly narrative, all these parents also have a very high level of indoctrination in the monopoly narrative. So when they come up and discover us, or anybody saying this sort of stuff, there's an immediate immune response to it. And the longer you've been indoctrinated in a certain mental model, the stronger the immune response, because you don't want to believe, or you don't want to accept, that 10 years invested in mental model A is wrong.
To kind of stress that a little bit more, and like, you can see it in the way that people become very loyal to youth clubs. I appreciate when people are loyal to my club, because it means I don't have to go out and recruit a whole bunch of new kids next year. Right. But people get a certain narrative in their mind about the way their club does things. And like, we are extremely different from the way other clubs operate. Like, we train a certain way. You're very well versed, because I ripped everything off from you, right? And how we train and the way that we do it and the philosophy that we have, we hold kids to a high standard because we believe they can rise to it. Whereas most other youth clubs are just kind of like, let them play, let them do their thing, whatever, right? And it takes a long time for parents to come around on, like, oh my God, like, that this actually does work when you just let it work. But there's so much kind of like emotional baggage of, well, shouldn't they just be out there running around and having fun and doing whatever they want at practice? That seems like when he's laughing the most. And to me, that's what I want for it. You know, I just want him to be happy, whatever. It's like, well, if that's what you want, we're not the club for you. Right. And so you almost have to deprogram them over time to get them to buy into your way of doing things.
It's very scary when you see all this stuff as you're growing up. I'm talking about you and myself, you know, you get all these years under your belt as to how brainwashing is real. It's real. It is real. When you're a kid growing up watching cartoons and you're like, oh, we're going to brainwash this person, you think it's science fiction, right? No.
Yeah, you think it's Manchurian Candidate. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, okay, yeah. Cool, a fictional story. It's fun. No, it's real. It's real. And that's why the media is what it is, because they are effectively programmers of human minds. You make sound with your voice, if it's an audio thing, and the sound waves penetrate the receiver's ears, and it literally makes your neurons fire in a particular pattern when you're hearing certain words. And if you send the same message over and over and over again, the neurons, the neurophysiology, gets ossified in a particular pattern. So you're literally physiologically changing a person's brain through the media that you're transmitting to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's incredible.
I guess we got to brainwash them earlier. It's the only way out of this, Gary. I don't know.
No, but that's why, you know, folks in power also try to grab hold of the education system. You grab hold of the education system, and you have all the parents drop their kids off at school for 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day for years on end. Guess what happens? You are literally programming human beings. You would like to think that it's benevolent. You would like to think that everything is kosher and right for the right reasons. And I'm sure a lot of it is, but this is a mode through which they program humans.
What's that old Rage Against the Machine line? Who controls the past now controls the future.
It's true. Yeah.
That's it. Did we miss anything here, Gary?
We could have talked about the girl a little bit if you wanted to.
Sure. Let's recap her a little bit. I think we got into it, but I feel so bad for her.
For sure.
First of all, I think her name is Abigail Velez. She's with ABC7 in Los Angeles. She's just a reporter or an anchor or whatever. And she went out before the Turkey match and was like, you know, she's out on the street at a watch party with an American, not a flag, but some sort of American U.S. soccer thing on her back. And she's saying, oh, no Christian Pulisic, no problem. The only turkey we're worried about is that Thanksgiving. Very mild, very mild. And to me, when I see this, I'll be very frank with you. When I see Chicanos repping U.S. gear, I'm like, yes, this is what I want. This is what I want. When I see somebody doing that on the news, I'm like, we're inching our way up, right? It might not be the most novel trash talk from her, but like just the fact that we have somebody hyping the U.S. on the news is like something novel to me and something exciting. She says something about Bosnia once the Bosnia game gets put on the schedule. And she's saying, I couldn't even point to it on a map. Who knows? No worries. We're going to take this thing. It's going to be no problem. And immediately that immune response, right? And it's not just from foreign countries. It's a lot of people in the U.S. that are attacking her for making such an ignorant and hurtful remark. And they made her apologize. ABC made her apologize. Or she just did it on her own. I don't know. I wasn't in the room when this decision was made to have her tweet out an apology, but she did. And it made me a little bit sad that like this person who's just expressing some love for the game, for the U.S. is like now being raked over the coals.
Yeah. So here's my interpretation of things. So she says what she says, right? I draw a certain line, okay? And the line I draw is between journalist/reporter and media personality, or somebody in the media that's not a journalist/reporter, isn't positioned as a journalist/reporter. From my vantage point, I want journalists/reporters to kind of conduct themselves according to the charter, right, of what a journalist is supposed to be, you know? And a journalist is not supposed to be out there, you know, stoking flames or making light of things or being controversial or, I don't know, shit posting, you know, that sort of stuff. It's like, no, I draw the line there. And I'm like, if you're positioning yourself as a reporter, as a journalist, wrong, big mistake, you know, but I also can't blame her because, again, I don't know what the incentives are in like that newsroom, you know, and journalism has decayed to the point where nobody's serious. Nobody's legit anymore. It's all a big clown show. It's all a big circus. You go to CNN, you go to Fox, you go to MSNBC, you don't go to any of these mainstream media outlets, New York Times, Washington Post, you name it. It doesn't matter if it's left, right, whatever. It's all a bunch of trash, okay? I don't see any integrity anywhere, you know? And so this, to me, this unfortunate girl, kind of embodied the trash, you know, by saying, I don't know where Bosnia is. I could care less too. You know, all we know is we're going to wipe our ass with. It's like, bro, are you a journalist? Like, what are we doing?
But I
can understand and appreciate where she might be coming from. My second interpretation is how the American soccer journalists / media / reporters, the establishment, the monopoly, that monoculture, reacted to her. They were throwing her under the bus, you know, instead of protecting her. You know, the way I view it is like, oh, she's giving us all a bad name, you know, by doing this. So I'm sorry, but we can't protect you, you know, because if we protect you, then I'm going to be targeted next, you know. So they were scared of protecting the girl, you know, so they trashed her too. They're like, see, we need to, this idiot, MLS list, MLSist, Pablo Maurer or Moyer, whatever the fuck his name, sorry for to your audience, you can bleep this out if you want. He's like, oh, we need to get back to shaming people, you know, when they're, you know, go off the rails like this girl did. Bro, you're the same. You're the same. You just do it in a different way. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You do it in a very, I don't know if nefarious is the right word, but in a very more nuanced, subtle way to manipulate the audience. You work and you get your rocks off of manipulating the audience and acting like you're professional and above it. Well, clearly you're not professional and above it, because I see the guy's tweets or the guy's ex posts and the guy's articles. He has a political ideology. He has all of these biases and he's deploying them through the work of a journalist.
Right, right.
So that's my whole view of this situation. I feel bad for her, you know?
Yeah. So there's one thing I want to say about that, because I think there's something to be said about, she's literally wearing her bias on her sleeve, right? She's got the American, the U.S. soccer thing on her sleeve, right? Whereas somebody like Pablo pretends that this isn't even a bias. This worldview isn't a bias. This is the way it's supposed to be, right? Mm. Back to the very monolithic set of politics and beliefs and worldview and like way of seeing the game. This is the way it is, right? And so like they're not honest about, because let's be honest, it doesn't matter. Walter Cronkite, right? Who was the guy? Edward Murrow, right? They all had biases too. And that's the human condition.
For sure.
It's about how honest you are about letting them bleed into your work or keeping it separate. And so for me, it's like, she filmed this harmless segment. Is it a bit cringe? Yeah, absolutely. It's not great trash talk. But like, man, give the girl some grace and let's move on with it. Like, what are we doing? And it's, I think part of it that's so distasteful to me too is like that immune response is the same. It comes back to that same worldview of like, we have to be ashamed to be American. We can't really like the U.S. national team because of whatever is going on in the country at the time. It's like, this can be something a little bit bigger, or it can be something a little less serious. It doesn't have to all be politics when we go watch a soccer game, right? Man, I had one more point on that. The other thing, and as a counterfactual, do you think it would have been the same thing if she would have said it on Telemundo in a Spanish broadcast with a Mexican flag around her shoulders?
No, I don't think it would have been the same.
It's not a super useful exercise, and it's not, I'm not trying to sow any division here. It's just literally like, is it really that big of a deal?
I don't think it's that big of a deal, but there's still this culture in this country where you want to cancel people.
Yeah.
That still kind of exists, you know?
Right.
And if somebody gets too much attention for some sort of take and for whatever reason, a particular in-group wants to eliminate you, they will gang up and try to eliminate you.
Yeah.
Which is really, really sad. And you can see it in her apology, right? I would like to have seen an apology. Like, I know I'm supposed to be a serious reporter or something, but that's not her job. Yeah. Maybe her job is not being a serious reporter. You know, I don't know what her job is. This is the first time I heard of the girl.
I think she's like a fill-in anchor is what her title is.
Okay. But I would like to see our journalists and reporters be like serious and objective and smart. And if you're going to cover this sport, at least go look at a map and look at where Bosnia is. And then, you know what I mean? Like do a little bit of homework or something. So that would have been my like, oh, that's where you went wrong, girl. But her apology is an appeasement to a particular mob about her not being sensitive enough to the Bosnian community, or it had that whole fucking angle associated with it, which that is what's revolting to me. Like, I don't care. You want to insult, if somebody gets insulted by your reporting or journalism, so long as it was objective or whatever, let them be insulted. If I want to insult right. Bosnians, I should be able to insult Bosnians. It's fine. You know, why should yeah. I be, why should I be canceled, you know, or attempted, somebody should attempt to cancel me and get me fired from my job. That's right. What bugs me too. Like, that's why I feel bad for her. It's like, you shouldn't have to apologize for this.
Right. It's, I mean, it is kind of funny too, that she goes with the can't identify it on a map. I don't know if that's like a conscious thing. Like if that's like a tongue in cheek, like Americans don't know geography and she's like playing with that, or if it's like, literally, it's so funny to her that she can't pinpoint it. And that, and she misses the irony altogether. I really don't know. But like the fact that other people can then insult her for not knowing and being a typical American is also funny. Like, so it's kind of like, yeah, people are going to be insulted. People are going to get things wrong. That's okay. As long as you're not intentionally misleading people, I'm probably okay with it. But yeah.
So many things we can talk about. Maybe we'll do another episode or something. Cause
absolutely.
I really don't like the rule changes that have been made for the FIFA World Cup. And I think there's a lot of common threads with what we've discussed today.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I think the hydration break and, you know, moving to does soften the game. So I'd be totally down for,
well,
for
that. Because Bielsa had a whole rant about changing the game to quarters. He literally said something that I found quite profound, and people will think it's superficial, but I find it quite profound. We've been coaching forever, Kirk, and we've been in this game forever. It's like, the moment you did that and changed it into quarters, you have eliminated a century's worth of culture. You've eliminated a century's worth of lessons learned in the game from a player's perspective, from a coach's perspective. You've eliminated a century's worth of methodology, optimization, and philosophies. You've crushed the game altogether. And folks might say, like, that's silly. Like, you're still kicking a ball around. You know, you just take a little break in between kicking the ball around. No, momentum, flow, psychology, tactics, everything's broken.
Yeah. It takes the game out of the players' hands, feet, I guess I should say, right? It puts the manager in a much more prominent position to have this little break, right? There's so many different things. And how has the media covered it? Oh, mm-hmm. This is an American thing. The Americans are the worst. It's like, well, first of all, this was FIFA in response to the players' unions across the world. Like, it's the group of players' associations that have gone for this because they were worried about it being too hot in the U.S. And like, it's like, even the way that's been reported has been underhanded and dishonest. So I think there's a lot to talk about here in the future as well about, like, maybe it's like a Mythbuster type of series where it's like, hey, that's not what this is. I don't know. We can play around with.
Okay, man. Cool. I had fun.
All right. Yeah, this is a good chat. I appreciate it, Gary. Well, until next time, we will catch you all later. Bye.
See ya. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.